Yes, I'm Nancy, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon, and I just want to say Carol's my new laughing buddy. We listened to the opening, Roger from Seminole, Florida, and he was funny, I thought, and so I would laugh, and then I would look at Carol, and she has the best laugh, and then I would laugh even more, you know, like, so it was like a double treat. So yeah, she's my new friend. But I want to thank Melody and the committee for asking me to speak. I was humbled and honored, and this breakfast is really special to me. I used to take my dad. He came to 6 of these breakfasts, and he loved the Roundup when he was alive. And the last one he went to, Jean Kay spoke with her granddaughter Molly, and we sat over there with Roger and Judy, and he had the time of his life. And so it's really special to me because it was always special to him. So yeah, my story. I did not grow up with alcoholism. Holidays and birthdays, no drinking. There just was no drinking. I don't know why, but there wasn't. So I had no clue, literally. And I remember there was a neighbor that used to get inebriated at neighborhood functions. And I remember my parents talking about it. You know, like, it's too bad he fell down and, you know, things like that. And I was about 8, and I can remember thinking, oh, he didn't learn good table manners. You know, and that was the sum of it for me. That was it. I just didn't know anything about it. So I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and we didn't have it in our family, although it is in our family sort of way back with grandparents and aunts and uncles and that kind of thing, but not direct. But I did grow up with a lot of denial about everything. My whole family is great at doing that. And I picked up that too. And I've realized since I got into Al-Anon that I can lie to myself about anything in a nanosecond, anytime. You know, when it's not, when I get fearful about something or it's not quite the way I want it to be, my head goes into, denying reality. So, and I'll give you an example of that in our family. My dad had a brother, Uncle Clem, and he would come out and visit my dad once a year for about a week. And I would pick him up at the airport, LAX, and take him to my dad's. And I relished doing that because my Uncle Clem was the only one in the family that would say everything about everybody. So you could find out stuff. And so I asked him about this Aunt Louise. I said, you know, that Aunt Louise, I've met her once, and nobody talks about her, and she's, you know, and people kind of whisper, and what's going on with Aunt Louise? And he goes, oh, with all this bravado, let me tell you about her. She bakes these pies, and they're the best pies, and she opened up a bakery in Sioux City, Iowa, and people lined up for blocks around to get her pies, and he's going on and on. And I said, oh, well, what happened to the bakery? And then he whispers, well, she started drinking in the evening, and then she couldn't wake up in the morning to bake the goods, and the family had to come and close the bakery. And I looked at him, and I said, oh, she was alcoholic. And he goes, oh, no, we don't have any alcoholics in our family. And that sums our family up. So I had a good childhood, and I went off to college, and I was 21, and I went to this party. And it was a beer keg party, and it was real casual. And you walked in, and there were just people scattered, and they were talking. And so there's this great big beer keg. And this young man, I was 21, there was this young man, and he had cowboy boots on, and he had his feet, you know, like a cowboy, like that. And he was standing in front of the beer keg all evening. And he looked like he was guarding it. And he was kind of like robotic about it. You know, he would put it here, and then he would pull up the beer, and then he would do this, and then he would look around, and he was a man of few words. And I looked at him, and I thought, I'd go up to him, but I feel like I'm interrupting something. So I didn't. And so I went to leave the party, and he left the beer keg to go over and talk to me, and I felt very special. So that was the beginning of our dating, my husband. And he told me when we were dating, he said, he started telling me about his family, and he said his father was a binger, and I thought, a binger, what's that? And he said, well, you know, he'd go several months without drinking, and then when he did drink, he was flat on his back for 2 weeks and would lose his job. So he told me, he said, my mother supported the family. And then his mother died when he was 16, and my husband took over, you know, trying to support the family. And when I was dating him, he was doing that. He was supporting his dad and going to graduate school and two jobs. And I admired him so much. I thought, oh, gosh, he's such a loyal son, and he's taking care of his dad, and this is such a noble endeavor. And I just admired what he was doing so much. And he told me that his dad had four siblings, and three of them left jobs, good jobs, and families, and died on Skid Row in their 40s. And the one sibling that did not die never took a drop in her life because she saw what drinking did to her entire family. And then he told me he had a grandmother, his dad's mother, who ended up in an insane asylum with wet brain in Idaho. And, you know, I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I can't imagine. I could not fathom what he was even saying to me and wrap my head around it. And I remember thinking, you know, boy, these table manners, you got to get them in early. I mean, they just can't, they can't go on like that. It's not polite to drink too much. I just couldn't figure it all out. So we got married. And then I was taking care of his dad, too. We both were. We both had full-time jobs, and we would empty our bank accounts every couple of months to pay his rent, to pay his utilities, to pay for his food. And my admiration for him taking care of his dad went south. I got so resentful, and I remember it was very confusing because I had never hated anybody before. But yet when I talked to his dad, I liked him. But then he would binge, and we would have to empty their bank accounts. And it wasn't just the money, it was the emotional toll of looking for him in bars and trying to keep him from drinking and taking his money so he wouldn't, you know, be able to buy any booze. And it was just, I was just going crazy with that. And finally his dad started having heart problems, so we took him to the doctor, and the doctor looked at him and said, you binge one more time and it's going to kill you. And his dad looked really scared. And we thought, good, this is it. It's over. He knows now. He's not going to drink. And really, and he didn't drink for 6 months. And we went over in 6 months, and we found him dead in the chair with an empty bourbon bottle. And my husband was not an emotional man. You know, there's just no emotion on his face usually. And I remember he ran out of that rented house, and he threw himself down on the yard, and he started beating the ground. And I thought he'd gone crazy. I'd never seen him like that. And I pulled him up, and there was just tears and dirt in his face. And he said, I tried. I tried all my life to get him to stop drinking, and I couldn't. And my poor husband was a prisoner to this disease from the day he was born. And so we buried my father-in-law. And I remember sitting there when we buried him, and I'm thinking, good, all done with alcoholism, done, over, never go there again, never. And I, you know, I thought that was it, and never say never. So, you know, our life went on, and it got better. You know, we were able to save and buy a home, and we had two wonderful children. And this went on for 23 years. And if you had asked me during that time, you know, what my marriage was like, I would say, oh, I have the best marriage in the whole universe. But, you know, there was this verbal abuse that was going on, and I started to accept it. It started out just hardly ever, and it kept increasing, and I started to accept unacceptable behavior, and you don't even know that it's happening, or I didn't. And after 23 years, it was bad, and I didn't, until the 23 years, I didn't connect the dots that, you know, when he drank, he raged. And because he really didn't drink at home. It was mainly at work, and he would come home. So he would come home, and he would start raging and pick a fight, and I would take the bait, and I was just as bad as him. I would scream and yell back at him, or I would cry buckets. You never knew what I was going to do. You knew what he was going to do. He was going to rage, but, you know, you didn't know which one I was going to do. And I remember I felt crazy. And finally, the denial cracked in me that he had a drinking problem, just like his dad. And I remember the date. It was February 13th, 1998. And you talk about impending doom. All I could think of was, you know, his dad in that chair with that empty bourbon bottle and those siblings on Skid Row and his grandmother in the insane asylum. And I thought, you know, I had no hope. And so I did what an untreated Al-Anon would do. He wouldn't listen to me. So I thought, you know, I'll call one of his friends and they can convince him. So I, he had this man that was, he really admired, that was very smart. And he lived, this man lived in New York City. And so I dug up his number and I called him. And this man had been married to, his first wife was alcoholic. So I thought, he can talk to my husband and he'll convince my husband that he needs to stop drinking. So I called him up and I told him my whole story and, you know, all the drama. And he cut me off and he said, "You need Al-Anon." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, it's for people who are affected by other people's drinking." And I said, "Oh," and I said, "This is not what I wanted to hear. I wanted him to talk to my husband." And I said, "Well, I've never heard of it, so I don't think we have any Al-Anon in Redondo Beach." And he said, "Stay where you are, and I'm going to hang up, and I'm going to call you back in 10 minutes. I'm calling Virginia Beach." And I thought, Virginia Beach? What is he talking about? So I waited, and he called me back, and I'll never forget. He said, "Okay, you got 20 minutes. Get down to Manhattan Beach on Peck, and there's an Al-Anon meeting there, and I'll talk to you after you go to the meeting." And I thought, darn. So I drove down there, and I'm thinking, oh, this is not what I wanted to do. And I remember I went there, and I thought, all of a sudden it hit me. You know, I was so arrogant about my reputation. I thought, we have a reputation. What if somebody sees me going to this meeting? And so I put on a big hat, and I put sunglasses on, and I slept like this. And I sat there watching people go in that room. And I thought, if I see anybody I know, I'm not going in. And so I had a lot to protect. So I sat there like this. And I didn't see anybody I knew, so I had to go in. And I sat in the back, and I slumped again. And I remember they asked for newcomers, and I thought, I'm not saying a word. And a couple of people turned around and smiled at me, and I thought, ooh, they know. So I said my name. And I remember when I said my name, I just started bawling. And it was, you know, the heaving. And it went on. It seemed like it went on forever. I couldn't stop it. And nobody said anything. You could hear a pin drop. And when it was done, I thought, oh my gosh, I never want to see these. I've completely humiliated myself. I never want to see these people again. I've embarrassed myself. I couldn't control my emotions. I was, you know, all that stuff that we do. And I thought, I got to get out of here. And I remember they said the serenity prayer. And while they were saying it, I was looking where the door was. And I thought, there's five big steps, and I can get to that door, and then I'm going to sprint to my car, and I'm never coming back. And so they ended the serenity prayer, and I turned around to do my five big steps, and I couldn't go because there were so many people hugging me. And it was the first time I just felt so loved by these perfect strangers. And they all hugged me, and they all said, you know, they understood, and I was in the right place, and to keep coming back. And I could see it in their eyes, and I could feel it in their hugs, and I could hear it in their voices. And that was it. That was the beginning of my journey in Al-Anon. And so the best gift I ever gave myself in Al-Anon was a sponsor. And a lot of you know her here. Her name is Jean Kay. And if you're a friend of Jean Kay's, you are one of the luckiest people in the whole world. That woman changed my life. And she is the kindest, most insightful, wisest woman I have ever known, and yet she has a heart of a lion. And she'll take you in and under her wing, and I just can't say enough kind words about her. And I'm just so grateful she took me on, because I was a mess. And I'm still a mess, but I'm not as bad a mess as I was. So thanks to her. So we did the steps, and my life changed, and the fighting stopped. And he still kept drinking, but I could have a good day, a happy day, whether he was drinking or not. And I didn't think that was possible. And so this went on for about 9 years. And then I started getting conceited. I can get arrogant very easily and lose my humility. And I've realized that about myself. If I don't do step 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis, that's what happens to me. And so I remember, I thought, yeah, I got this program wired. You know, I'm happy. My husband's still drinking. How many people can say that, you know? And, you know, I was like that. And I remember I was only going to about one meeting a week. And then wham, you know, life hits you. And my youngest of my two children, my son, his behavior started to scare me. And I remember he was doing well in school, and he was doing well in sports, and he was doing well. But there was a shift in the attitude, and there was a shift in the behavior, and I started to worry. And when I worry about a loved one, I cross this border into crazy town, never to come back. And I remember it was his junior year, and I found some pot in the garage, and I panicked. And I thought, oh, I got to nip this in the bud. I forgot step one. And so I thought, I came up with this idea. It was one of those crazy town ideas. I thought, I'm going to follow him, and I'm going to find his dealer. And when I do, I'm going to turn them both over to the police. And I'm going to punish him, and I'm going to shame him, and then he'll never do it again. We'll be all done. And I didn't tell my sponsor because I didn't think she'd understand. So, and then when you're not going to tell your sponsor something, it's probably a bad idea. So that's what I did. I rented a Ford Focus, and I got a white wig, and I put sunglasses on. And I followed him. And let me tell you, people, don't do it. It was a big waste of time, money, and unnecessary worry. And he didn't go to the dealer, and so that was a little crazy town thing I had going. So he went off to college, and I worried some more. But I wasn't seeing him on a regular basis. But when I did see him, you know, I could tell he was partying a little too much for my comfort. So I worried and worried. And then he got his first DUI. And I called my sponsor, and we talked. And she said, yeah, you're dealing with another alcoholic. So I had my husband drinking, and now I got my son. And I was like, oh, dear. So... and then 4 months later, he got a second DUI. And we were waiting. He'd started not showing up at family functions. And we were going to my daughter's graduation, and I was just, you know, hoping he would show up, and because she would be so disappointed if he wasn't there. And he showed up, and I thought, oh, good, he's here. I'm so happy. And he comes in, and he sits on the kitchen table, and he puts his head down on the kitchen table, and he started crying. And he said, I've tried. Like, I just got out of jail again. I've tried. I can't stop. I can't stop drinking. And I remember my whole body went, oh, no. And I tell people this because it was such a physical reaction. You know, I remember my heart just felt like it went right into my stomach, and my hands started shaking. And I thought, I can't go on. I can't do this. But I went over to him because I'd been to enough open AA meetings and enough Al-Anon meetings and enough literature that I knew this was a big step for him to say, I need help. I went over to him and I hugged him and I said, this takes a lot of courage, and I'm really proud of you for saying that, and of course we'll help you. And I said, why don't you take a shower? You've been in jail all day. Take a shower. And, you know, my motive was not to clean him up. My motive was I wanted him out of earshot so I could call my sponsor. And so he went and took a shower, and I called my sponsor, and I told her everything. And I remember I said, I can't do this. I'm telling you, I can't do this. I said, I did it with my father-in-law. I'm doing it with my husband. I cannot do it with my child. I can't. And she said, just like that, she said, honey, this is what we do. We love alcoholics. And that did a shift in me. I thought, yeah, what am I thinking? You know, I've got her. I've got the 12 steps. I've got all my Al-Anon people that love me, and I love them. I've got the wonderful literature. I can do this. And so I went back down, and we took it one day at a time, and he went to rehab for 4 months. And let me tell you, you know, when you know they're safe and they're not drinking, life's good. So But I was worried about him coming home because, don't forget, my husband's still drinking. And so he came home, and my sponsor called me, and she said, okay, we're going to do three things. She had this plan. We're going to redo the 12 steps. Fourth step again. And then she said, and you're going to pick up more meetings. And she got me this wonderful parent meeting in Palos Verdes. And they held my hand through all of that when my son moved home. And then the third thing we're going to do is, she said, you're going to call me every morning and tell me what's in your head. And I thought, what? But because she knew I go to crazy town very easily. And I'll tell you one crazy town experience I did with her. But this time I told her, so I didn't carry it out. So she said to me, I said to her, I called her up and I said, you know, I said, I'm sitting there, I said, he won't get a sponsor. He's been home for 3 weeks and he won't get a sponsor. And he can't stay sober if he doesn't get a sponsor. It's driving me crazy. So I came up with an idea. She said, what's that? I said, well, you know, he can't drive because his license was taken away. And I said, and so I take him to this Monday night men's stag meeting. I said, I could drop him off, wait for him to go in there, and then I could go up to different men that are going in there and ask them how long they've been sober. And if it's 5 years or more, tell them who my son is. And she, in other words, get him a sponsor. And she said, no, you can't do that. And she said, but I'll tell you what you can do. You can tell him that you would be more comfortable if he would get a sponsor. What a concept. You tell people your feelings. And I did it. And you know, I felt better. I can't even explain it. You say your feelings, you know, just in a non-judgmental way, and it just kind of cleared the air for me. And you know, a month later, he came home and he said, he got a sponsor. So I called her up. I said, he got a sponsor. I'm so happy. He's working on the steps. I can't believe it. And she goes, who is he? And I said, oh, Bill something, Bill C or Bill Cleveland, Bill Chicago, I don't know, something like that. And she said, oh, I've known him for over 20 years. He's in good hands. Could I have gotten him a better sponsor? No. He managed to get his own sponsor without his mother. So he went to Bill and Karen's house. And I just want to tell them, you know, I am so grateful. They opened their hearts and their homes to my son. And every time I remember he came back from doing the steps with Bill, I saw him transformed. It was just a little bit every time. And it was a wondrous thing to watch. And I will forever be grateful for how loving and kind they were to him and taking him under their wings. And I can never thank them enough for that. And at the same time, my son started to love my sponsor, and I'll tell you a little thing that happened with that. So Christmas time, you know, my husband's drinking really picks up the pace. And one holiday season, my sponsor fell and broke her shoulder, and she said she was going to have surgery, and she couldn't talk to me for 2 or 3 days. So I came home, and I said to my son, oh, poor me, it's the holiday season, you know how Dad drinks, and I can't talk to my sponsor for 3 days, poor me. And he said, no. Poor me. And he said, I have to live with you for 3 days unsupervised. And that's the truth. So he's grown to love and appreciate my sponsor. So my husband, you know, keeps drinking. And when this disease is not arrested, It progresses. And the direction that his disease started to take the last couple of years and the behavior, I started to have a really, really hard time with. And we've been married 40 years, and that's a long time. And I was like a pit bull. You know, I'm going to hang on forever. And the behavior, there's a pamphlet that we have that we read in our parent meeting, and I love it. It's an open letter from the alcoholic. And I love that letter, and I always have, and because it so poignantly explains the compassion and the understanding for people who are afflicted with this disease, and that part I could always relate to and accept, and it explains our powerlessness over this disease in a very poignant way. But there was one paragraph that bothered me, always bothered me the last couple of years, and I didn't know why, but it would like make me flinch. And it was the only part of that letter that I didn't like. And let's see if I can remember it. It said, don't let me exploit you or take advantage of you in any way. And then it said, love cannot last very long without the dimension of justice. And what was happening was, you know, I allowed my husband to take advantage, and he didn't respect me anymore, and it was dying. That what we had 40 years ago was not what we had, and so I was really grappling with, you know, should I leave or not leave? And I finally decided to for both of our sakes, to file for divorce. And I just want to say, it's been really painful, really hard. And but my sponsor has loved me through this every day, as always. All of you have. I've had people, you know, offer to come to court hearings with me and text me, and just so sweet. And I couldn't have. And my son has been there for me when it's gotten rough. And I'm so appreciative of everything everybody's done with that. And I want to say that the last thing I want to say is that it's helped me with other people. And my dad got sick with cancer in 2013, and I went in and I lived with him. We got hospice. And my son came every day to help me with my dad. And nobody asked him to do that. And I've never seen anybody treat anybody with such tenderheartedness as my son did with my dad. And he, this kind of cancer, he lost his use of his legs. And so Andy would come over and lift him up and put him in the wheelchair every day and you know, and bathe him and do all of that. And my dad would say that when he first started doing it, my dad would say, you shouldn't have to do this. You shouldn't have to do this. It's not fair to you. You shouldn't have to lift me up. And my son looked at him, and the very first time he said that, and he said, you look at it as lifting you up. I look at it as giving you a big hug. And my dad's face broke into this huge smile, and he kissed Andy on the top of the head and rubbed it like a Buddha. And from then on, whenever Andy lifted him up, my dad would smile and kiss the top of his head. And it was a privilege and honor to watch that interaction between a grandson and a grandfather. And I wouldn't have had it if I hadn't had Bill and Karen and all of the people in AA and all of my sponsor and all of the people in Al-Anon. And just thank you so much for giving me those beautiful moments at the end of my dad's life. Thank you.